The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted today to be able to speak to fund manager James Thorne of Columbia Threadneedle Investments. So welcome, James.
Hello again, Paul.
Yeah, well, we've had a bit of a strange January, a bit of a hangover after the strong pre-Christmas Santa rally. That was largely on the back of sort of expectations for interest rate cuts. But putting all that together, what's your sort of outlook for equities for the rest of the year, particularly in your sort of sweet spot of sort of small and mid-caps?
Well, I think it's going to be quite interesting because I think my message or view would be things are gradually going to get better and in lots of different veins from what was a very difficult 2023. And really that could have quite a powerful effect on especially my world, the small mid-cap market, because valuations are at such low levels. And I think as all of those things start to gradually improve across the real economy in terms of corporate profits, but also the valuation of equities because of interest rates. And I think we've already seen a lot of data, and that's what got the market very excited at the end of 2023. And the market sort of, you know, as per usual, overran slightly in terms of the expectation of interest rates being cut. But, you know, I think, you know, the data is continuing to reinforce the point that interest rates will be cut as we go through this year. Lots of speculation as to when that might be. You can ask me for my view if you want. I think.
Yeah, probably, no, please give us your view. I think
probably May is the most likely. May or June will be when the bank makes the decision to cut rates. But I think we could be quite close, getting close to 4% by the end of the year, 4.25%, maybe 4.5% if you're being really bearish. But obviously that will have quite an impact in terms of everything from the costs of borrowing money. But a lot of the banks have already done that in terms of reducing the costs of borrowing money over the next 3 to 5 years, because they can see inflation coming down and the expectation that the cost of money will come down as we move through the year. And those banks are competing for mortgages. So I think, you know, there's been a lot of commentary, and obviously the mortgage market's incredibly important to the UK economy, about the start of this year.
Yeah, I think we're going to get sort of animal spirits as well, aren't we, if interest rates start coming, well, hopefully it will still start coming down. And I guess with the small and mid-cap space, because they operate at that floating spot rate, you know, it's usually a margin plus spot or margin plus floating, which is because they haven't really been accessed to the bond market where they can turn the debt, then you'll get an extra level of beta benefit, particularly if the yield curve starts steepening for small and mid caps compared to large caps, which did term out their debt in 2021, I guess.
Yeah, I think you're going to get a multiple. I think one, the discount rate, which sets the valuation for equities, is going to fall, but also you're going to come to the end of downgrades. The market is forecasting earnings growth for 2024. And a lot of the headwinds that we had on corporate profitability, but also demand in the economy, will start to fall away. So, you know, we had corporate taxation up last year materially. We had cost pressures for companies. Those cost pressures are now going to start to become tailwinds, comparing that to 2023. And as you say, you know, the UK consumer since July, you know, one of the best trackers is the ASDA disposable income tracker, which anyone can go and have a look at online. And that's a weekly survey of or indication of you know, people's wealth creation after they've paid all their bills. Now that's been improving since July of last year, and will continue to improve. And I think one of the consultancy firms was out obviously giving a view about the reduction in energy costs come April, which I looked to fall mid double digits. So, you know, a lot of those things will mean that, as I say, you know, the market will and the economy will start to slowly, incrementally look better and better as we move through the year.
Yeah, just on the sort of on the technical side, have we sort of like finished the sort of fund manager redemptions? Because that was an artificial drag last year on sort of small and mid caps. And likewise, we've had a bit of the last sort of 3 months a boost from sort of M&A activity. What's your sort of your latest both on those, just as sort of like potential movers in the small and mid cap space?
Yeah, I think it's obvious that we, you know, the UK has had significant outflows post Brexit. And I think we pretty much have got there. If you look to domestic institutional mandates, most of those who is sort of historically in the very long run had overweight positions to UK equities are now more in line with the global indices. So they're not now having a disproportionate overweight. And you've got to remember that the majority of the UK market is held by overseas investors. And I think, you know, they're looking at the UK, actually considering that, you know, the economic growth, as we've had adjustments to prior data on economic growth, has been nowhere near as bad as people might have expected. And actually the outlook for the UK is, you know, is potentially better than many of the other geographies globally. And because of the way that energy is treated in the UK market and obviously impacted us to a greater extent. And that is going to start to roll off as we go through 2024. So I think yes, that the fund flows, I think, have gone past their worst point. Yeah. I don't think anyone's suggesting that we've seen huge inflows, but I don't think you'd need a huge amount of inflows. And as you say, if there aren't, the other mechanism is M&A, which sort of leads to tension across the market because you're taking that capital out, and that capital then has to flow back into the market.
Yeah, we've seen a real jump, haven't we? I mean, how do you interpret that splurge in sort of all things M&A, and particularly the last 3 months? I mean, almost every single week we're getting another deal, in fact, one or two or three.
Well, I mean, I think if you look at it from an absolute market cap, it's not been a huge splurge. There is a potential for that to come. I think there's been quite a few in terms of number, and there's been an awful lot of activity of approaches, and that has been on a weekly basis rather than necessarily consummated. And I think the reason why that activity is picked up is because debt is available in the markets. That if you went back to the end of Q3, there wasn't the debt availability that private equity needs to make those acquisitions. I think at the moment it's quite difficult because, you know, there's a lot of value in the market, but there's trying to connect forecasting for next year, which can be difficult, and therefore private equity is looking for an extreme bargain versus actually paying necessarily fair value, which obviously the board of directors has a fiduciary duty to only agree to a takeover if they believe it's fair value for the company. And so I think there is quite a gap between those two numbers, and that's what is making the consult, you know, actually deals completing a little bit harder than it would normally be. But I think unless the market moves upwards, you're going to see a lot more of that activity as we go through 2024.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Okay, well, let's move us to some of the stocks. And there's one which has been sort of quietly sort of like outperforming is One Spatial, run by Claire Milverton. And these does sort of like location, sort of geospace or big data type sort of software and services. It sort of like looks after the Network Rail and United Utilities and Ordnance Survey to sort of like bring all of their assets together in one huge data lake, and therefore you can sort of like then get huge productivity improvements, particularly sort of field forces. What's your sort of latest on this one? Because it's been under the radar. It's about a market cap of just under 60 million, but churning out. I mean, the shares have just been one way, but I mean, not obviously vertical, but certainly from the bottom left to the top right.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's in a very interesting place. You know, this business has some unique technologies that are patented that, you know, a trend across lots of industry of digitization of data. There's a lot of hype around AI, but even before you get to the hype around AI, having data in a digital format that represents the real world. I think a lot of people imagine when we talk about data that they look at sort of the office environment. Now, this is obviously of the physical environment, as you say, of utilities, pipe work, underground. And this is not just in the UK. I mean, a lot of the names you mention are the Ordnance Survey, United Utilities, but they're also working across Europe with German utility companies, but also in the US with the Californian Department of Transport in terms of following all of those assets. And this is really in very much in the early stages of that transfer of all of that data, but then also what you can do with it. And one of the exciting products that has been trialed by many customers, and obviously we're waiting, hopefully, as we go through 2024, they're going to sign some commercial agreements, is really the automatic planning of traffic works around, obviously, the investment in CapEx that's needed across the, all of those pipes and wires across the UK. Now, that should make that whole process an awful lot more efficient and save their customers a material amount of money in executing on that. And I think there is a global opportunity here. And the business has been through a big investment phase over the last 3 to 5 years. And I think that's why it's very, very interesting. And then that's really, you know, what we look for in the fund. We look for businesses that have got incredibly strong positions in a market that's growing because you have a desire to digitize your data because it makes you more efficient. It leads to better outcomes for customers. And it, you know, it's important to all of us who are paying water bills and electricity bills that those assets are being managed as efficiently as possible. And really to do that, you need up-to-date clear data. And a lot of these industries are a long, long way behind. You know, if you compare it to what we all have on our desktops or our laptops in terms of, you know, Microsoft products that allow us to manage our data, if you considered the version that sits within utility companies or electricity companies, you'd be shocked at the starting point. Now, that is improving rapidly, but, you know, it's starting from something that's more akin to the 1970s than the 2020s.
Yeah, one of those Intel 386s or something like that, sort of power in it. But yeah, you're probably right. And now another one in this sort of the geospatial sort of like data play is IQ Geo, which I think basically focuses on utilities and telecoms in particular. But rather than actually aggregating all the data, they do sort of like, I think it's they do data twins of networks. So plan, build and operate those particular networks to get them the sort of most efficient. It really has had, you know, done accelerate. The share price has done really quite well. What's your sort of the latest on this one? Because it seems to be, say, not just the big data play, but it's actually a really quite, you know, specific sort of vertical market sort of category for the software.
Yeah, well, I think it's a very interesting, exciting space because there's an awful lot of investment into broadband globally. We're still going through, you know, there's a lot of people already have broadband, and you might go, well, surely that's done. But if you look at a lot of countries across Europe and the US, we're still, you know, really not really halfway through that investment. But then behind that is also utility investment. And again, I guess that links to One Spatial. But this is really the same expectation that you and me would have in our personal lives about having that data available. So this is a mobile first application. And the starting point is about designing those networks. And I think it would amaze anyone listening to this, but also ourselves, that if you're designing a broadband network, up until very recently, you would be using some toolkits, but ultimately be done manually by individuals who are highly trained and often not as efficient. And when you're talking about in the US, billions and billions of investment into broadband, but what will come in utilities is trillions of investment to modernize the network for electric cars and other requirements on the network to be much more smart to allow renewable sources of energy. You need to do that efficiently. And IQ Geo's design software, which is the front end of its relationship with its customers, can save as much as 5%. Now, that might seem like a small number when you're talking about billions and potentially trillions of investment. That's a huge amount of money. And obviously, it's not just the financial benefit. There's an awful lot of other benefits in terms of around the flexibility and all sorts of stakeholders having access to that information.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I think it's, I didn't really appreciate the whole sort of network design and with not only with this sort of like the broadband side, the wireless, the 5G build out, but you also, once you've built it, you've got to have a good network software to be able to optimize it. And likewise, as you say, with the electricity side, with so the national grid and people like that. Yeah, huge. Now, just moving to slightly different one, telematics. We've got micro leads, which I think sort of like listed about 2 or 3 years ago. It's one of the... It's done okay, actually, I think. It sort of like looks after the sort of say the telematics for HGV sort of trucks and stuff across Europe. What's sort of your latest on this one? I did notice it's got recurring revenue streams of about, I think it's 2/3 of its total sales.
Yeah, I mean, Microlise, I think, is a really, really interesting company. I mean, we look for businesses that have got really strong market positions. And Microlise has 60% market share in the UK. Mm. So if you think of any truck fleet as you're driving down the M3 or the M1 and you're passing a truck, you know, there's a long, you know, could be Sainsbury's, could be Asda, could be Boots, any one of those, you know, large players, their truck fleet will probably use Microlise's software to manage the efficiency of that network. Now you might say, well, hang on a second, you've got 60% market share. Surely this is a business that's trundling towards maturity. But there is a big opportunity, not just to sell their products internationally, because they are best in class, but also domestically as they add additional functionality, which helps in lots of regulatory changes, but also the efficiency of that fleet and fuel saving, obviously also critical, but also better monitoring and can help in terms of driver training, driver safety. So there's lots of ways that Microlise can increase its market position. But I think the important thing is with that market share position, it really understands its customers and it really understands how to make those new products or the services it provides to add value to its customers. And I think that's a very interesting thing in software, because often people ask me, you go, well, hang on, can you really have intellectual proprietary property within software? And you can't ultimately really, but what you can have is industry and customer intimacy. And really understanding your customer and really understanding the problems of your customer means you can make really great software for them, which your customers really value, and ends up in a very sticky relationship. And that's really the holy grail that everyone's looking for, is these SaaS revenues, which are in perpetuity, ultimately recurring revenue, which generates ultimately a very, very high quality cash flow. And that's because your customers really value what you're doing for them. And Microlise is interesting because, again, a bit like OneSpatial and IQ Geo, they've been going through a long investment phase, and the market's kind of forgotten that actually these businesses can be highly profitable and they want to be. But what they're doing is ultimately they're investing in increasing the size of that opportunity for the equity owners.
Yeah. And also, because it's got 60% market share, that's huge barriers to entry, because you get your network effect. And, you know, when it comes to sort of pricing and margins, you get economies of scale compared to anybody else. So, yeah, I mean, that makes it really tough. In fact, it's quite an interesting observation. A lot of the stocks you've chosen are sort of like in this environment, are reducing, you know, companies' costs and improving productivity. And another one is Active Ops, which does basically workflow sort of management for banks and for insurers, really sort of like in more of a hybrid world as well. So it's not only people in sort of call centers, but also, you know, they might be actually working at home, and it improves the productivity. Can you give us the latest on this one? Because it's still continuing to sort of like, you know, grow organically. And I think it's just reached EBITDA profitability.
Yeah, again, it's very similar to the other companies we've talked about. You know, there's a huge market opportunity for the business. They've got some really good customers, and because of those long-term relationships with those customers, they've built some additional products which really save save their customers a lot of time and money. And as you said, it sounds simple, but it's actually very complicated. Yeah. You imagine you're running an insurance company and, you know, I have a flood in my house and I want to go through an insurance claim. I might be dealing with a business that has several thousand employees all over the world at, you know, almost dozen, maybe even more locations. And you have to manage the workflow processes that they have to execute and the number of staff that are working at any one time to deal with different levels of workload. So, you know, the floods in the UK recently, you'll suddenly be inundated with claims and you have to manage that surge in demand within your business. And ActiveOps does that in an automated way, but also allowing managers to manage it with a toolkit that makes them much more efficient in doing that. And yeah. I can't talk about ActiveOps without introducing the idea of or concept of generative AI. Yes. And everyone talks about it, but I think where it's really interesting is where that you're making these products even better. They're almost being turbocharged by AI. And many software companies are introducing applications that link into generative AI when you can make these applications even better than they have been historically.
I totally agree. I think the HMRC could definitely do with the ActiveOps system because they don't even answer the phone nowadays. In fact, I think they've told everybody they're not going to actually take a call, a single one, until the end of the tax year. But no, you raise really good points. And just on the sort of the AI, another one you've got in your portfolio is FD Technologies, which came out with a bit of a softest trading update not long ago. It's got three divisions: KX Insights, which is a really sort of crown jewel AI play software to help people look at real-time mass data, largely used in the capital markets, but also now being increasingly used outside of the merchant banks and the fund managers. And then you've got a sort of like a consultancy business, IT consultancy business in the capital markets, which is the old First Derivatives. And then finally, you've got MRP, which I think is a sort of like an advertising sort of marketing business that is sort of stabilized. Can you give us your latest on this one? It has come down quite a lot. And I guess it's probably one of those unbundling plays that some of the private equity guys are now putting the slide rule over.
Yeah, well, I mean, the company is undergoing a strategic review of all three of those businesses. But I think, you know, I would suggest that probably the best outcome is for them to stay together for the moment. But you do have three different businesses. I think most of the value sits in two of them. FDP is a consultancy which works with pretty much all of the major trading banks in the world, providing very fast time series databases to look at data within the markets very, very quickly and make decisions upon it. And then back to my point earlier around software. And the key thing about software is customer intimacy and industry knowledge. And that's really in the financial space where actually time series databases were really, really relevant. Now, with the adoption of AI by many industries and ultimately everyone over time, you need time series database. That ultimately means you need to make calculations in real time as quickly as possible with huge, vast data sets. I mean, the mind boggles. We're talking sort of trillions and trillions of data points. And to do this efficiently, you need a lot of computing power. And this is why everyone's got very excited in the US about NVIDIA, because this is whereby you're processing, rather than using a CPU, central processing unit, you're using a graphics processing unit. Now, graphics processes in a different way, which can be a lot faster, a lot more powerful. But that means you need a lot of hardware. You need a lot of chips. And those are very expensive and they're also restricted. Now, you can actually use software tools to do a similar thing. It's called vector-based processing. And a lot of people in the financial space have been using that for decades, but in quite a cottage industry way, using open source software. Now, KX has effectively put this into a scalable platform in the cloud by linking partnerships with AWS, Microsoft, and on their Azure platform, and also some lesser known names, not so much high street names like Snowflake and Snowpark and others. And this effectively provides this time series database to process these huge amounts of data incredibly fast. It's actually a thousandfold quicker, and there are actually some other toolkits that can make it even faster than that. So it really is a game changer in terms of speed and efficiency. And you're going to need it. And what it does actually mean is it means that you will need less NVIDIA chips. So a huge cost saving to actually processing this, but also a big environmental benefit. If you think that, you know, Microsoft has their sort of trialed sticking server banks underneath the sea to reduce the costs of cooling them and the energy to cool them, you get a big reduction in the amount of processing power by using KX's solutions. Now, you mentioned the trading update. Yes, you know, this business is in the early days. Really, KX has been a relative startup. But in actual fact, if you look at the revenues that KX has versus Pinecone and some of these other names in the US, which have got valuations in the billions, KX actually has, much higher levels of revenue and in actual cash terms, much greater growth. But we are at the early stages of that. And I think when they reported at the half year, growth was only 15%. But there was a very large order book. And it really just is about the amount of time it takes for people to convert to using the product and what is quite a new product, but with a very, very compelling return on that investment. And look, I think the news flow might be a bit bumpy. Their year ends the end of February. But I think over the next couple of years, we're going to see, obviously, a lot of customers wanting to adopt their technology because it's going to save them a lot of money.
Yeah. And also, I mean, there's a huge difference between private market valuations of sort of like, you know, top-notch software companies and what the actual market is currently valuing it. Because, I mean, most of them are sort of like on a, you know, single sort of 2x, 3x sales and or sort of 8, 9, 10x EBITDA. And often in the private markets, because of the gross margins of these things is 90%, then they'll pay, you know, double that. Because it's a sort of like a crown jewel just generally, isn't it, for sort of like software companies?
Well, I think, I mean, yes, if you look at the US names, there is, beg your pardon, there's a grouping of US names. And I think, you know, you the rule of thumb, and most of them, obviously, they've all got different attributes, would trade. If you're growing at sort of 20% at the revenue line, you'd be trading at sort of 8 to 10x EV to enterprise value to sales. Well, I'm sure you have the data there, but you know, even if you exclude all of the other components of FT Technologies, you're trading at a fraction of that.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, good. Well, let's move on to just the last one on the sort of software side, which is Auction Technologies, which basically does the sort of like the software for and runs the software for lots of sort of like auction houses and then sort of industrial sector, but largely in the sort of the arts and the, you know, the sort of like the that particular area. What's your sort of your latest on this one? Because again, it must have huge barriers to entry because, you become a sort of category killer, I guess.
Well, I think I always think of it because, you know, it doesn't sound that exciting when you talk about it, but I always see it as it's a bit like poker in that you need a big pool of liquidity. You know, as you say, you know, auction tech are effectively selling big diggers or antiques. And the point is, if you're selling a big digger or antiques, you need to find all the people who want to buy a big digger and antiques. And, you know, poker would rely on having a big pool of people because you've got the best prize money.
Yeah.
Here, you're looking for the best price for your asset. And the bigger the pool of people, the better price you get for that asset. And that's really been proven, that price discovery is a big reason why more and more auctions will move to online. But you don't just want to move to online. You need to move to the place where there's the greater pool of people watching those assets you're trying to sell. And that's really what auction technology, I believe, has achieved. As well as, you know, I always imagine it's sort of the eBay of antiques and professional antiques and yellow steel, as they call diggers.
Caterpillar machinery.
I didn't want to take brand names, but, you know, there are other diggers available.
Komatsu.
because you're sorting out a lot of the financing, but also a lot of the delivery. Yeah. Now, maybe less so for a digger, because you're probably going to collect. But if you're selling, you know, antique vases, you know, in terms of sorting out the finances of putting down the product deposit, the final payment, and then also delivery and shipping. ATG is providing these services, and that's really in strong growth. And really, ATG suffered because of asset price declines, because of the restriction of assets post-COVID in terms of there weren't enough diggers being made. The residual values were held up for some period of time. Now they've been falling because we're entering a more normalized world. That's been a drag on the growth of the business for the last sort of 6 to 12 months. But I think as we go through that normalizing point, I think the fact that, you know, you're on this long-term trend of improving liquidity on its marketplaces, then that virtuous circle is going to work. The more people that are on your site is going to attract even more people. And I think ATG has got that critical mass of liquidity in its markets.
Yeah. Well, if I'm looking for a new tractor, I know where to go for a lower price. Okay. Well, let's move to the industrial sector. We've got Avintrans. I know we've talked about it, but again, it sort of still keeps sort of growing, particularly on the sort of the top line. It's a sort of specialist engineer in nuclear, oil and gas, and sort of blast-proof doors. And it does, in the nuclear side, it does new nuclear, it does extensions and also decommissioning with sort of high-integrity storage boxes, and also has got a pretty exciting medical business in MRIs and 3D x-rays that is just sort of like going through. Part of it's already got FDA approval. I think the MRIs is coming this year. But can you just take us through your top level on this one? Because it's the two Steves have had a great time for 15 years and done a superb job, isn't it, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds quite complex when you talk about all of that. I mean, I hope the Steves won't mind, but it's all about pie. And I'm not talking steak and kidney, but purchase, improve and exit is their mantra. So, you know, they've done an incredibly good job of buying businesses, improving them and then exiting them and either returning that cash to shareholders or looking for other deals to invest in. And I think over the next couple of years, they're going to exit some of these companies that they, you know, that they purchased and improved. And as you said, that, you know, you sort of think, well, what is the common feature here? Because you've got all these broad industrial businesses, and they're ultimately industrial businesses that have got very sustainable, very strong and potentially growing market niches, but were mismanaged for many different reasons. Now, you know, there's a big spread in terms of opportunities. Some of them are, you know, not amazingly exciting. They just needed managed better, reduce the costs, and they sell those on. And I kind of see it as you've got this sort of good set of industrial companies, as you say, in specialist areas like nuclear, and they'll just nicely, you know, continue to do well. And the Steves will ultimately recycle that capital at the right point. And then you have this option of the medical side of the business. It's got some really potentially breakthrough technologies, which have now been fully developed and approved by the FDA. And really now it's about moving to the go-to-market strategy for those products. And as we've talked about in the past, it's quite interesting. If, you know, people are interested, you can go to their website and they've got some demo videos of Adaptix, which is this 3D x-ray. And I know, you know, in this world, I'd much prefer if someone was looking at my hand because I've broken it, a three-dimensional image of it rather than just two-dimensional. You're less likely to miss things as a clinician. And you know, we'll have better outcomes. And as we've talked about in the past, you know, anyone's been for an MRI scan. Yes, okay, if you need a full body scan, you need to go into one of those tubes. Let's hope you're not claustrophobic. But if you've got a problem with your knee or your ankle or in veterinary practices, and, you know, the ability to x-ray your pet's dog or leg if they've been injured, then, you know, a small format MRI, not only is it much lower cost, and therefore many smaller practices will be able to have one to get the best imaging possible. So it's a big potential market, and I think they're working through their route to market, but pretty much the technology risk of developing the products is now complete. So really it's now about monetizing that opportunity.
Yeah. And also, you know, in terms of the healthcare systems, I mean, they've got such a big waiting list and backlog. they need something which is easy, cheap, and gives a gives exactly the right thing for small, you know, so hands, wrists, and feet and stuff like that on MRI and X-ray, because you can't get a big MRI flipping appointments or a big body scan on the X-rays. It's difficult on.
I think they need a massive, great reinforced concrete floor to take the weight of the MRI scanner.
Yeah,
and then you're dealing to cool it so that the magnets can work. You need liquid helium. And sort of the price of liquid helium is a bit, so it's quite similar to sort of vintage champagne. It's not cheap. So if you can take out the vintage champagne, then you've got something that's an awful lot cheaper.
Yeah, good. Okay, brilliant. Okay, well, let's move to another one in the sort of the industrial sector, slightly different part of it. It's Tecmar, smaller company, does sort of historically has been servicing the oil and gas sector in the North Sea and in the sort of Middle East with electrical connectors, but is increasingly now using the same technology and deploying it in the offshore wind and renewables. And I know it's got contracts at the big offshore wind in Dogger Bank out in the North Sea. What's sort of your latest on there? Because it does expect to, well, I said last time, to be, I think it was EBITDA break even with revenues sort of about 40 million. But I guess it's coming out with a training update fairly soon.
Yeah, and you know, we're obviously hoping that we'll start to see an improvement in that market. I think, you know, it's got some very strong market positions within those markets, which ultimately are growth areas. But in actual fact, you know, it's one of the issues of you get growing pains in some of these big long-term opportunities, such as offshore wind. And really post-COVID and some changes in terms of the tax structure, there's been a big pause in the number of wind farms being built in the last couple of years. And I think 2023 hopefully was the low. And the forecasts are for a lot of growth, not just in the UK, but globally in terms of offshore wind farms. And there are also a lot of issues around the contractors. You know, there are big players in this market doing these, and they were struggling to make money on a lot of these. And that's really just because of the sophistication of the bidding on these contracts. And I think all of that started to improve, and Tecmar was sort of suffering at the back end of that. And I think as we go into a sort of a slightly more sophisticated marketplace as backing growth, then Tecmar's got some really interesting technologies. And obviously, you know, offshore wind is one of the key technologies that we need to go through this energy transition. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see. It's got a very experienced investor that's come on board, and some pretty experienced management team. So, you know, they've weathered a pretty tough storm, but hopefully we're coming through that. And there is a very interesting long-term trend in offshore wind.
Yeah. No, I would highlight to investors, I mean, it's got sort of like its market cap's about 15 million. It's got about 1 million estimated of net debt. So EV is 16, but the sales are 40. And you hope, given that it's in that sort of offshore wind and offshore oil and gas, it can repeat sort of like an Ashted technology type stuff and benefit from the natural growth. But it's still work in progress, but they may just be behind them. We'll wait and see. Okay, let's move to the house builders. You talked about, obviously, they should be benefiting from the interest rates, and a lot of them have. But one which hasn't is Crest Nicholson. It's had a sort of like a couple of sort of legacy problems, particularly in terms of the sort of the Grenfell stuff, and there was also a couple of project managers. It's the one house builder which is reasonably large, still about half a billion market cap, got cash on the balance sheet, that is trading at a significant discount to its net tangible assets. I think its net tangible is over £3, and it's trading at just over £2. What's your sort of latest on this one? Because is there a catch up, or is it basically a catch down?
Well, I hope not. You know, Crest had gone longer term through some woes, and Peter Truscott, who's just announced his retirement, came on board, I think the back end of 2018. And the thing with house builders is that, you know, it's very long cycle. You know, you have to buy the land. You either have a land creditor, so you sort of put some money down to start with. You go through a planning process. as you go through that planning process, which is very, very elongated, you then decide exactly what sort of product you're going to build. And then you have to obviously go through the exercise of building it. And then at the back end, you need to sell that product, and you don't know what the market might be at that point. Now, Crest had all of those woes, and it took, you know, Crest, for as a relatively small house builder, were doing things that were just too difficult for it, really. It was building tower blocks. It was developing, you know, sites of special scientific interest, sites of, you know, restricted sites in terms of, I think they had one site in London with a mulberry bush that caused great controversy, but it was also just a very complicated site to deliver. Now, they've worked through pretty much all of that, but there's still a few bits and pieces that are coming through as exceptionals. Now, the market, especially when an area has been very, very tough, does fixate on those, you know, those final problems being the main reflection of the business. But, you know, the business has moved on a long, long way in that period, and just really has to get very good at just building good quality houses. And it's moved a long way there. But in a declining house price market, the market's been very worried, you know, obviously about your ability to execute. And the better backdrop that I think we'll see this year, you know, I think Rightmove's come out with some pretty positive data. RICS, which, you know, is the Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors in terms of expectations of improving house prices. And I think Crest is now pretty much getting close to having gone through that restructuring process. Then you should, over time, with that better backdrop, see a significant improvement in margins. And I think that will give the market confidence that, you know, the business is now on a firm footing. So it's a combination of, you know, a very difficult housing market, which is now getting better slowly as we go through 2024. But also, you know, it's always the case at the bottom of the market, people have lost confidence in people's ability to deliver. And, you know, Crest has had a tough time, but it's I think it's always that saying, it's, you know, necessarily you're not as bad as you looks like it is right at the bottom of the market. And as you say, you know, relative to the independent valuation of those housing assets, the business does trade at a very material discount to that independent valuation.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And I think also just on a risk reward level, we're not talking rocket science about building houses or infrastructure, all this sort of stuff. And most of the improvement they can do is self-help. It's not having to sort of, like, you know, external, et cetera, even though it's a better backdrop. So yeah, I would have thought if there's good management team in place, then they can increase that sort of the blueprint for developing these products, making more efficient, more consistent in quality. And you should see a catch-up trade there.
Well, I think so. I think Peter came in to, you know, sort out the business. The new CEO is coming in, was from Persimmon, you know, one of the largest house builders, and will come with, you know, the disciplines on how to build houses efficiently.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move to another one, Marlow, which is a tech-enabled sort of like services business that helps regulation and compliance in industry for a whole bunch of different areas. It's gone through a really fast sort of buy and build. It's got now scale, but somebody told me it's bought sort of 36 companies over the last 3 years, so almost one a month. And it's had a couple of sort of slip-ups just recently. It's got quite a hearty debt. What's your sort of your outlook at this? Is this a sort of like a fallen angel that can get back, or is it a sort of like do you need to go through, needs to integrate all these acquisitions to get the economies of scale?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's in a very interesting marketplace, you know, in terms of compliance is something certainly sitting in my industry is, and it's not just in the financial space, that everyone is more aware of. And again, doing that efficiently is difficult to do. And that's why they've invested in a tech platform to help the delivery of that. Not just whether it's actually people going in to inspect buildings at one end of what they do, to, you know, the provision of training to your workforce and your staff. I think to your point around, you know, when you have a business that's buy and build, you can obviously get very excited about it, because ultimately smaller, less liquid companies, private businesses, where maybe private equity isn't even interested because they're too small, come on low valuations. And so you what I call, you know, it's valuation arbitrage. You can buy those businesses on really low valuations and stick them into your own business. The big danger with that is if you don't integrate them properly. And the interesting thing for me is actually Marlowe's being penalized for doing the right thing. And they've invested quite heavily in a technology platform to allow all these businesses to be properly integrated, as well as taking the costs of that integration into the business. And as a result of that, in the very short term, it's looked like the business hasn't generated an awful lot of cash. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that cash that cash return is starting to improve. But I think, you know, the market to some extent felt that was a sign of lack of quality of the business. And I think over time, we will start to see that cash generation come back through the business. And then it will actually show really the quality of some of those clients. I think it was unfortunate in the last period, you know, quite a rare outcome that one of their clients decided to go in-house. Now, I don't think that's a trend. I don't think it's what lots of people will start doing, but obviously it was unfortunate in the period. And I think that also undermines some people's confidence in the business's ability to deliver.
Yeah. And I guess it's also got, its net debt is about just over two times EBITDA. And imagine if you've got high recurring revenues, that it's fine. But if you've got sort of like any doubt with investors about the variability of earnings, your EBITDA, then you get a sort of discount, don't you, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I think the business, most of the revenues are pretty high quality. I mean, if this business was held by private equity, it would have at least a 4.5 net debt to EBITDA ratio. So, you know, I think when you've got 2x net debt to EBITDA, it's really more about liquidity. It's about how long is your banking agreement with the banks and are the banks happy, rather than the business being overgeared and that causing the company a material issue.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on to sort of legal and professional services. We've got Knights Group, which is one of the few, actually, which has done pretty well. Trades at an incredible sort of like 6 or 7 times PE. Got a reasonable balance sheet. What's sort of your latest on this one? It just looks mispriced to me. About 110 million market cap.
Well, it takes... Yeah, if you make a mistake, people punish you for a very long time. and poor David, I mean, they did make a mistake. And I think they put their hands up and say they made a mistake during COVID. You know, they bought a business. They were quite, what would I say, you know, reacted quite quickly and aggressively to the situation in COVID. But I think annoyed a lot of people that sat within the business. I think ultimately what the business is doing is providing very high quality legal services across the regions. And they hire some incredibly high quality people because they like working in the environment that Knights creates and that not everyone's carrying a quota. So you're not running around trying to win business or, you know, grow your business. You're allowing the company as a whole to sort of build that relationship with the clients. And as a result, it creates a different culture. And I think, you know, you've seen the business succeed in that. Your growth has not been stellar, but that's been in a period where property transactions, but also M&A transactions have been on their knees. And yet organically, this business has continued to grow. I think when the market returns, you know, Knights has done the right thing by continuing to invest in people. So it has significant spare capacity in some of those verticals. And when that market comes back, obviously the profitability will materially increase. But I think the market, as you say, derated this company very aggressively post, you know, that era during COVID. And yet the business has now delivered, I think, 3 trading periods. The business has delivered exactly as it said it would do. It is a bit second half weighted. The year ends April, but I think it's, you know, so far, I think when they last spoke to the market, everything was as expected, even in what is a difficult environment. And that lends itself to the fact that, you know, it builds these really strong long-term relationships with its client base.
And it also pays just over a 3% dividend yield. So you're getting paid for whilst you wait. Now, another one in that legal services sort of area. Well, it's a basically a UK listed insolvency litigation company, Manolete. Its market cap is about 70 million. has got about 12 million of net debt. I mean, it's number one in its particular market to sort of like sort of fund cases largely against sort of directors who have got cases against them, etc. But to take the director, so it sort of benefits from the insolvency cycle and compulsory liquid sort of like a voluntary redundancy sort of stuff. What's sort of your latest on this one?
Well, I think, I mean, it's a really interesting business model. I mean, it's in a real niche of the world where, you know, you wouldn't necessarily look at. And I certainly, when I looked at it, you know, it was like, well, I'd never really thought about it. But ultimately, there are lots of businesses that go insolvent. Most often, the issue is that it's unpaid tax. And so HMRC wants to come and get the unpaid tax. Most insolvency practitioners would go and appoint somebody to go through that process. Now, unfortunately, they wouldn't own the case. And quite often what happens is the legal fees and the complications of going through that legal process means that, you know, the costs almost outweigh the tax that's outstanding. So Manolete's model is very different in that she buys the case. And therefore, in terms of keeping the legal costs down, is quite important. And they've got a very good track record of recovering monies primarily for HMRC and delivering very good returns. The slight problem with it, obviously, you're investing up front. The good thing is Manolete actually cycles this cash quite quickly. It's about a year that it takes to actually get settlement. But COVID caused a problem because effectively insolvency was made, was sort of banned, if you like, during COVID. And so you had this big gap. And then you have to fill the funnel. And while you're filling the funnel, you're not generating any cash and you're not getting a return. And then once you've filled the funnel, then you get to a point where actually the business, having grown quite quickly, will become self-sustaining, i.e. it can grow at a reasonable rate with all of its own internal generated cash. And I think that will come in the next couple of years. And that then creates really a very powerful model. COVID caused Manolete some big issues because insolvency stopped. I think we've got to a point of normalization of insolvencies, but it's also actually just the maturity of the business of getting to enough scale where, you know, and I don't, they haven't indicated or announced it, but one day they will be paying, I would see a dividend and that will be able to grow quite consistently with the business as long as obviously they can execute.
Yeah, and they're also helping, aren't they, Barclays, or even some of the other banks, to, with their bounce back loans, which came through on COVID to recover some of the monies which haven't been paid back by certain companies who have maybe gone into insolvency, I guess.
Yeah, so I mean that's an additional new market, which obviously, you know, won't go on forever, but you know, potentially could be an additional area for them to operate in. And I know there's been sort of several trials being run because there's a pretty big outstanding market. And when I say won't last forever, I mean, you look at PPI, which I think, you know, when it started, people thought it would run for a couple of years. And I think it's been running for over a decade now.
Perhaps have another one, actually. I think it's in car sort of like leasing financing, well, yes, isn't it?
That's to come. I mean, that we won't get the conclusions of that till the back end of this year. But
another boost
that
for
potentially
UK
could run on for a long time. Yeah,
yeah, another one. Okay, well, let's move, just change gears and go into the payment sector. Lots been happening here in the small cap space. Let's take two of them. We've got Argentex, which is had a trading update and a management change about 3 or 4 months ago. It's now going through a strategic review. It does sort of like Forex payments, really on a sort of white glove approach for sort of like fund managers and corporates and high net worth individuals. And then you've got Equals, which is more of a straight through processing platform. Both companies are expanding overseas. Equals is currently in doing the strategic review, and I think private equity Madison Dearborn Partners is having a good look at the actual business, so nothing firm yet, but just top level in terms. Let's take Argentex first, and then maybe you can say anything on, or maybe not, I don't know, on Equals.
Yeah, I mean, the payment space is a huge market, and therefore they're not necessarily directly comparable. Argentex, as you say, is right at one end of the spectrum. It's institutional levels of service, but they are starting to automate some of those processes. But obviously there is a big opportunity for Argentex in terms of where you have institutions who aren't particularly pleased with the service levels they're getting in terms of treasury functions from the big clearing banks. And so, you know, that opportunity is very large and obviously international. And they've been going through that process of obviously setting up that capability in Europe, but also in Australia. And I just think that business has gone through some growing pains in terms of working out, you know, exactly how you want to deliver that solution, but getting all parts of the business actually delivering all at the same time. And I think the new management team have got a lot of experience of running businesses of that type and have got a very clear strategy and vision for delivery. So, you know, we're watching this space, but, you know, we expect some interesting, you know, potential news flow in terms of, you know, delivery. Equals is at the complete opposite end. So it's still B2B. So we're not entering the B2C world, which is very, very competitive and has all the brand names that all know about, like Monzo and Revolut, and there's a list as long as your arm. This is primarily in the B2B space. And I think often people haven't understood that because Equals has really transitioned from actually, you know, a Forex, you know, they used to have Forex counters in the city where you'd go in to get your travel money, as well as a B2C business. They still do have a B2C business, but it's relatively modest. But this is really around delivering, as you say, straight through processing and managing your treasury functions in businesses where there's a lot of complexity because there's a lot of travel or a lot of different clients or a lot of different payments and different currencies. And they've really put that platform in place, as well as the regulatory structures you need to actually scale it. And that is actually very difficult to do. And a lot of the payment companies in this space have really run out for growth, especially in the privately held names, and not really put in a robust tech platform that you can scale. And as you say, you know, they have entered into a process. Obviously, under that process, bidders are allowed. They're allowed six bidders, but obviously the name bidder is Madison Dearborn. And I can understand why they're interested, because Madison owns several payment businesses, including MoneyGram. And that technology platform, I would have thought, I mean, I don't have insight into the businesses they hold, would potentially be very valuable to them. But I think there's a lot of other players in the market who've started payment platforms, but would like that scalable technology platform. So, as you said, there was an extension to the put up or shut up, I think now until the 21st of February. But this obviously started in the 1st of November. So there's obviously a lot of activity behind the scenes. And they did update the market with a trading update saying that they were in line. But you've got to also remember that they got their regulatory approval in Europe in November. And obviously it takes some time to sign up clients. And then once you've signed up clients, Equals saw a lot of that business transfer, all of that business transfer from other sources. So you'd get this, once you've signed up those clients, a sort of a kicker to revenues. So I guess the market's looking for, having got all of that regulatory approval in Europe and customers that would have operated in the UK, but obviously got operations across Europe, to see what that means in terms of the benefits of having that approval.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, that even if the strategic review for Equals doesn't happen, then the growth trajectory, growth trajectory in 2024 and 2025, given that you've just launched the same sort of, like, you know, full sort of end-to-end sort of tech platform over in Europe, which is much bigger than the UK, should really sort of be a pride of tailwind, no doubt about it. Okay, well, let's just finalize on we'll finish off on one of the payments. You've got WAG Payment Solutions, which I think does sort of, like, you know, payment solutions, but for a particularly vertical, sort of, like, you know, fleets and HGVs and trucks and stuff like that across Europe. What's sort of your latest on this one? Because I mean, it seems to be still doing pretty well, even though it's quite difficult market, I guess, for transport.
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's always the vision here really is to be the Uber for small trucking companies across Europe. So this business started as offering payment services. So, you know, you're running a trucking company, all of your drivers would have a fuel payment card. you'd go into a commercial, petrol station, and you'd fill up and you'd use the fuel card.
Yeah.
And obviously they'd try and offer the best terms in terms of pricing on fuel. Now, they wanted to branch out of that because trucks crossing across Europe, across many borders, have tax and tolls to pay, which ends up being quite complicated. And it always amazed me when I started looking at this company that the average trucking company in Europe has 6 trucks. So, you know, that's a lot of admin. If you're if you're primarily driving these trucks, I mean, in terms of, and it doesn't just stop there. It's also finance payments, MOT payments, all of that complexity. And what WAG is going to launch in the second half year is a fully integrated technology platform that allows you as a trucker not just to pay for your fuel payments, but to pay for your tolls, your tax, even finance payments. But and ultimately, over time, find business for your dead loads. So, you know, you might get a contract to take, I don't know, let's think of something, I don't know, flower pots from Spain to Germany to a retailer. And then you might be looking for a leg back from that. Well, back to the point, a bit like ATG, when you've got the liquidity pool and you've got all these truckers, you can then start to find them additional work by filling in these dead legs. And obviously also this is has a big environmental benefit. Yeah. And also Eurowag is forward thinking in that they have all the network as trucks start to convert to alternative fuels, whether that be LPG or electric at some point in the future, they also have that network in place. But really, again, it's making these truck drivers' lives a lot easier, but also making sure their cash cycling in terms of having to pay tax and tolls gets cycled back to them as quickly as possible. So yeah, I think it's, and even without that, you know, this business is still delivering these services, but it hasn't been integrated into one platform. And we've seen the fact that this business, even in a really difficult backdrop in parts of Europe, has been growing at double digit. And obviously we think once this platform is in place, it will be even more compelling to its customer base.
Yeah, and also sort of congestion charges. It would be useful for actually for sort of passenger cars. That
you want it as well, Paul? Do you?
I do. Like, yeah, I'll put it onto my Fiesta, which would be pretty useful. Okay, well, let's just got one stock in the healthcare sector, Oxford Biomedica, which basically does a really sort of niche gene therapy treatment or technology that helps gene therapy pharmaceutical companies put their effectively manufactured cells into, you know, into a format that they can then get put back into the particular human. It's actually surprising. I mean, no, it's not profitable, but its market cap's about 180. It's got about 10 million of cash, and it's 120 million of turnover as well. So it's not that expensive, actually, for really quite high IPR-rich healthcare business in a very hot area of gene therapy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that point about it being loss-making is a bit of the problem for the market. I mean, we don't tend to invest in loss-making businesses. There is a very clear strategy and path to being profitable in the next 18 months or so, which is why we feel comfortable to stick with the business. The business lost its way slightly in that gene therapy is a very interesting sort of area of therapeutics. And Oxford Biomedica was trying to do both. Not only is it a CDMO, an outsourced manufacturer of the gene therapies, so the most known and most commercially available is Pfizer's Kymera, which is sold for cancer, and you know that has grown over time. Now a lot of the big majors have been basically developing their own gene therapies, and they've been producing their own actives, but these are complex things to manufacture. Yeah. And what they've slowly realized over time is that they need to outsource to a quality provider who can deliver the consistency for them. And obviously with all of the safety issues and clinical requirements that come with that. And really Oxford Biomedica has the scale, not just in Europe, because it has manufacturing plants in France, the UK, but also the US. But also the expertise to manufacture it efficiently. And it's like many industries, you know, all those industries often start being vertically integrated and, you know, you're the developer of the novel therapeutics, but you're also manufacturing all the components. And it's only natural over time that you look to outsource that to people who are focused on delivering them that incredibly well. They've got a very, very experienced management team. And I think they're winning, you know, they're starting to win a lot of business. And as a result of that, as they go through that process, then the business will turn a corner. And again, they also had a COVID hangover because they were producing the AstraZeneca vaccine, which was on contracts. That really helped the business. Well, I mean, obviously it helped us as a society. And so thank you very much to them for scaling that very, very quickly. But what it also did was it actually helped them in terms of putting that infrastructure in place to now win business across other gene therapies. And we're just really at that pause, having bought a business in the US, having seen those COVID revenues fall away, and we're going back through the build-up phase. So again, it's just really the direction of travel. You know, the market's lost a bit of confidence, but you know, as I said, it's got a very experienced management team.
Yeah, I will not be surprised if something like a big CRO decides to put the slider all over them, actually, because they get something really quite unique into their business. Okay, let's just move to the last final section, the consumer. Let's just sort of quickly go through three of them. We've got a Gym Group, Halfords, and Reach, which does the Mirror Group. So Gym Group is a low-cost gym operator. Seems to be doing pretty well. I guess it's got... it's got continued growth as people sort of want to get themselves fitter, but also it's got higher costs with in terms of, you know, minimum wage and stuff like that and electricity and utilities, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of those costs will start to fall away in 2024. But also it just took a lot longer than people might have expected for actually people to return to the gym. You know, I think, you know, people want to stay fit. I think the low-cost operators, Pure Gym and Gym Group, they're the two main players in the UK. They offer incredible value for money to their customers. I mean, 24/7 access to gyms for, on average, I think it's about £18. Yeah. Something a month.
My daughters use them. I mean, they're great. Yeah,
and you know, they're clean, lit, safe, and you can have personal trainers if you want for additional costs. But it's just taken a time to build that customer base back up. And I think as they build that customer base back up and those costs fall away, then the business is in, you know, in a great position. Halfords is interesting. You know, Halfords has suffered again for two reasons because of COVID. One, because of bicycles, because everyone went out and bought a bike. That market's been really tough. I think the key thing for Halfords is they're winning market share. They've got an amazing value proposition. The offer is really, really good for value for money. And when the market recovers, they'll keep that market share. But the story here is much broader than that. They're auto centers business. I mean, I don't know about you, but you know, I own a VW. Right. I've got the
oldest it, James.
Not that old. It's a hybrid environment. Okay. I live in London. My choice is to drive all the way up to Hampstead where I can have an appointment to get my car serviced by VW in about late March. Or I can go to Halfords, which is half a mile around the corner. And now they're starting. They have that captive audience because everyone knows Halfords, everyone's got a relationship. They're putting, you know, when your car needs services MOT'd in your mobile, in your hands. And they're actually, and I think also the great thing is they're doing differential pricing. It's always frustrated me that somebody wanted their car MOT'd on a Monday morning, pays the same price as if you want it at 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning. Well, quite frankly, with my busy life, I'm very happy to pay a premium to have it done at 10 a.m. on a Saturday morning, but I want a slot. And I think they understand that and the customers understand that. And they're starting to benefit. And then the final thing on Halfords, which ultimately they will benefit from, is the tyre market recovering. Everyone's been running their tyres unsafely, probably right to the limit. And so the tyre market is still down and that will obviously recover. It has to recover because ultimately people's tyres wear out. But on top of that, there's another interesting thing, which is a software product called Availa. They've sold this software product to some of the main garage owners globally. And there is still a lot of opportunity for them to continue to sell that software product. And hopefully that chimes with what I said at the start of this call, in that it's all about customer intimacy and industry knowledge. And the reason why everyone's bought the Availa product is because Halfords has been using it in its own garages to make it more efficient and provide a better service to its customers for like 10 years. And that's why all of the major players, or some of the big major players in Europe and the US, have started to use it.
Yeah, and I did read a sort of like, it was a rumor in the press, wasn't it, that somebody's having a look at them as well. So given that the shares are, I mean, they're still pretty cheap, no doubt about it. I mean, they're 9x PE, so cheap as the bikes, actually, great value. The final bit, which is even cheaper optically, is Reach, which does the sort of mirror newspapers and all that sort of stuff. I guess what it's got is a big pension deficit that it needs to pay off. And it's a bit of a, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it might be difficult, but it looks a bit of a sort of like a melting iceberg with the news print newspapers that eventually they're cast as a cash cow, and it's transitioning to digital to make sure that you stay relevant going forward. What's your sort of outlet? I mean, it's incredibly cheap, 2 or 3x PE if you strip out the pension.
Well, I think the pension, it's difficult to know when exactly the pension gets sorted. But if you look at the funding levels of the pension, that will happen in the next three or 4 years. And so the near to £50 million, I think it is, a year that they've been paying to the pensioners, you would assume that would fall away, which materially increases, obviously, the cash flow of the business. But to your point, well, that's no good if you've got a melting iceberg, as you say. But you know, the assets that Reach has are national, but they're also local assets, and they're relevant locally. And a lot of people read their content, are very interested in their content, and that's clear because basically the transition to digital has been very effective in that they've been signing a lot of people up who are willing to share their details because they want a better service for Reach in terms of they give them more of the information that they want, more of the editorial that they want. And obviously this is very, very valuable to advertisers. Now, that piece of advertising is much higher quality, less cyclical. The programmatic piece, which is where advertisers just buy literally programmatically, there's a program that just buys it, is much, much more cyclical. And there was a big chunk that was still left within Reach. And so the transition was underway, but the cycle kind of happened at a point that made that quite difficult for the business. So over time, that will transition, but also you have the cyclical recovery from advertising. And it is sort of the fourth year in that, and it's always generally an election year in the UK and an election year in the US. And I mean, there are 40 elections globally, is generally a good year for media spend and advertising. Yeah. But also that initial conversation we had about the housing market, but also about disposable income, is going to start to improve quite materially in 2024, gives quite a tailwind. And I think although the print market is ultimately slowly in decline, it is actually held up better than people expect. There are people who still want to read a physical newspaper. Yeah. They are obviously more recycled than most other consumer goods. So I don't think there should be anything too negative around that. But as you said, you know, it's priced as if this business is only around for the next couple of years, which I think there are many reasons why, in actual fact, it can deliver a sustainable cash flow in perpetuity.
Yeah, and I'd highlight to investors, if you're looking for an income play, this does over 11% dividend yield. So there's plenty of cash still coming out of that, out of the, you know, basically the whole the print side and the digital side. Okay, brilliant. Well, thanks very much for your excellent insights there, James. If somebody wants to invest in the sort of the Columbia Threadneedle funds that say you run, how best to do that?
Well, we're on all the platforms, Hargreaves Lansdown, AJ Bell and others. But also you can actually go to the Columbia Threadneedle website and invest from that platform. But thanks again, Paul. I really appreciate it. It's always interesting to talk about the portfolio.
Yeah, well, I want to say I'd highlight to investors, have a look through some of the stocks because they're absolutely fabulous, and I'm going to have a good pick through them. So thanks again for your time, James, and look forward in touching base in 6 months' time.
Great. Thank you. Bye-bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.